You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis, and today we're taking you to the streets of New York City. They're jammed with people, street vendors, traffic. One thing you don't see, though, are long rows of camping tents on the sidewalks, a common sight that you see in Los Angeles. That's not because New York doesn't have a homelessness crisis. In fact, more people are experiencing homelessness in New York City than in all of LA County. But in New York, many more unhoused people sleep indoors. That's partly because New York has a law guaranteeing a right to shelter, meaning the city must provide emergency shelter to every unhoused person who qualifies for that help. Could that happen here in LA? Well, one state lawmaker is proposing a similar law in California. And in the city of Los Angeles, Councilmember Mark Ridley Thomas has proposed a right to housing ordinance. Not the same thing, but he says temporary shelter could be included in his definition of housing. Meanwhile, an ongoing federal lawsuit is also pressuring the city and the county to create more shelter beds. So today, the question, how did New York's right to shelter mandate come to be? How is it working? And what could LA learn from it at this critical moment? KCRW's Anna Scott, who covers homelessness and housing, she's here to discuss with us. Hey, Anna.
Hey, Steve.
So how did New York's right to shelter begin? How did it all get started?
It goes back to the 1970s to one unhoused man named Bob Callahan. I didn't talk to Callahan for this, but I talked to someone named Robert Hayes, who knew Callahan really well.
He was a pugnacious guy, and he was troubled. He was a short order cook before he kind of fell on hard times.
Back in the 70s, so more than 40 years ago, Hayes, who you just heard, was a young law student at NYU, and he was volunteering at a homeless services center. Later, he went on to found the Coalition for the Homeless, which is a big nonprofit advocacy group. But he started out all those years ago as a volunteer, and that's how he met Bob Callahan. Callahan at the time was in his 50s. He was suffering the effects of severe alcoholism, and he stayed on the streets around Lower Manhattan. Hayes became really disturbed by the fact that a lot of unhoused New Yorkers were suffering on the streets and dying on the streets, and he wanted to do something about it.
And I had absolutely no influence, and no one really particularly wanted to talk to me. And honestly, back then, none of the large nonprofit charitable organizations were particularly interested in helping homeless people. There was no money. There were no contracts. New York City did not have a $1 billion-plus homeless budget. And if the city and state governments wouldn't help, the federal government's not going to help. What do? You get angry, then you go to court.
You go to court. So Hayes eventually brought a class action lawsuit against the city, arguing that there's a constitutional right to shelter in New York. And it was on behalf of all homeless men in New York City, because that's who was mostly unhoused at the time there, single men. And Callahan was the lead plaintiff.
So I assume, Anna, that they won the case.
They did.
On behalf of men, you mentioned men. How did the law then expand to include everyone, all genders?
Well, after they won that first case, New York didn't just go out and build thousands of shelters overnight. There were subsequent lawsuits, and together over time, all of these cases forced the city to greatly expand its shelter beds and also who they had to provide shelter for.
And how much, Anna, is this related to weather? You know, you hear it over and over again. It's easier to be homeless in LA because the weather isn't as severe as it is in New York, although it can be obviously deadly to be homeless in Los Angeles. At least here we don't have those freezing winters, right?
Yeah, that's right. Good question. It's very deadly to be homeless in Los Angeles, by the way, but you're right that the weather is a big part of what happened in New York. And now that New York has a really big shelter system, the weather is a big factor in driving people into that system, even though many of the shelters themselves aren't necessarily nice places to be. I talked to someone who has firsthand experience with that. Her name is Ebony Holden. She's worked in social services in New York City for more than a decade. And years ago, she stayed at a New York shelter herself.
It was just so dangerous. It was like, of course, I know there's no privacy, but you're in a gymnasium and there's like cots just lined up next to each other with like maybe a sheer curtain, possibly, you know, and they're like, oh, well, don't take off your shoes. You might not have them when you wake up. People are fighting or, you know, someone got stabbed. It was just like, I'd rather live on the streets.
Well, she's obviously not on the streets anymore, but it certainly does go to the reason, or many reasons, that people sometimes refuse shelter. They don't want to go. They don't want to be vulnerable in a position like that. She was eventually able to find a place to live. So was it the shelter system that ultimately helped her?
It was one piece of it. She didn't stay in the shelter system for very long. But of course, for some people who go into shelters, it is a stepping stone to permanent housing and a better situation. Holden, though, also said that in her work now, she sees people get stuck in shelters in a kind of long-term limbo. And one thing that advocates didn't foresee when all of this began was that homelessness would get worse, not better, in the decades after that original lawsuit. So in New York City, that means the shelter system has ballooned and become this permanent fixture. New York spends about $3 billion a year on homelessness. You might remember recently it was really big news when LA Mayor Eric Garcetti said he would spend $1 billion on homelessness in the coming fiscal year. Well, a lot of the costs in New York are related to maintaining that big shelter system. And some homeless advocates see that as a problem. One person I talked to is Deborah Padgett. She's a social work professor at NYU.
The shelter industry is a multi-billion dollar industry, and there's absolutely no incentive from the city or from these nonprofits really to end homelessness, to put it bluntly. It's not that people don't want to end homelessness, but there are thousands of jobs now that depend on homelessness.
I hear what she's saying, Anna, but even if the shelters are not ending homelessness, they are helping people get in off the streets. I mean, they receive meals, people who are experiencing homelessness get services, and yeah, they do provide jobs, I guess, while they're at it.
Yes, and that's the way that many people in Los Angeles look at this too. I should say nobody I talk to defends unsafe conditions or unsanitary conditions at shelters, but assuming they meet basic standards, many feel that LA needs a lot more emergency resources like New York has, even if it's not the perfect solution. One person who feels that way is Andy Bales. He runs a shelter here on Skid Row, the Union Rescue Mission, and he would like to see California or LA adopt a law like New York's.
I'd say leaving people 60,000 plus in shelter is much better than leaving 70,000 plus with no shelter whatsoever in Los Angeles, dying on the streets, suffering a brutal death, you know, hunger, thirst, too much sun, cold, suffering brutal assaults and rapes. Los Angeles has no standing to criticize New York's approach at all.
And I don't think many people would argue with him on the idea that the status quo here just isn't working. I mean, your eyes don't fail you. People are dying on the streets in record numbers. People live in tents and encampments on sidewalks and in parks all over the place. We see this time and time again. So is there a way, Anna, to bring more people inside while avoiding some of the negative sides of New York's shelter system?
Well, I asked a lot of people that same question. One thing that came up several times speaking with policy experts is California's Project Home Key. That's one example of something that perhaps could the state or local jurisdictions could do more of. That's the effort around California to buy motels in cities like LA and convert them to temporary or permanent housing. It's something that's in between shelter and the traditional type of permanent supportive housing that takes a really long time and costs a lot of money to build.
What do the people who brought the original lawsuit in New York think about how it's turned out all these years later? Do they have an opinion about it? I'm sure they do.
Yeah, well, sadly, Bob Callahan, the unhoused man who was the original plaintiff in that lawsuit, died while sleeping on the streets of Manhattan before the case ever led to any new shelter beds. But Robert Hayes, the lawyer, has mixed feelings. He says that on the one hand, he's horrified by the scale of today's homelessness crisis. A huge shelter system to respond to that crisis is not the outcome that he hoped for.
I dread talking to people who now see homelessness as something that is part of the American landscape. It wasn't supposed to be. We were supposed to end it, and that was success, and we failed abysmally. On the other hand, having the bedrock in New York of shelter did for sure save lives. So I will condemn the right to shelter because shelters are lousy institutions. And I will celebrate it as a lifesaver for a bunch of people who really needed it.
So, Steve, it's a real paradox.
It sure is. No easy answers for sure. KCRW's Anna Scott, who covers housing and homelessness. Anna, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
All right, it's Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Got plans this weekend? It's coming up. Want to learn more about your city? Well, here's an idea. Take an immersive adventure along the Metro Expo line.
All aboard!
Wait!
I can wait.
That's the new audio play called March of Time, Time Warp, which follows an unusually frank tour guide through more than 100 years of LA history.
Running this quickly through a city, through time, is exhausting. Oh, give me a second. Oh, thank you for waiting.
150 years.
Oh, that's a long time.
Relative.
I got lost.
That's Los Angeles for you. Everyone gets lost and then everyone gets found. That's why we got so much religion here.
It's one of five plays produced by what's called Chalk Repertory Theater that launched this weekend. Each one brings to life unsung landmarks in Leimert Park, historic West Adams, Union Station, Exposition Park. Luis Alfaro joins me right now, the playwright behind that piece you just heard, and Jennifer Chang, who directed the entire project. Thanks to you both for being here.
So great to be here, Steve.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for having us.
You bet. This project, it's called Chalk Lines. It's described as an activity. I mean, you're sort of coming along on this Metro train ride. Explain what it is and how you hope people will engage with it. I mean, is it interactive? It's certainly immersive.
Yes. I mean, you know, the hope is that people might venture out and take a ride on the expo line. And I do have to say that that was the original intention as we started to shape this project actually about 2 or 3 years ago. And then the pandemic hit and we thought, oh no, I guess we can't encourage people to leave their homes and maybe we can bring the districts to them. And so we really produced this to be able to be enjoyed, whether from the safety and comfort of your own home or maybe with some encouragement to check out some of these locations.
You have said that your mission is to reveal Los Angeles to Angelenos. What do you mean by that? What do you mean reveal?
Well, you know, speaking personally, I've had a sort of 180-degree turn to falling in love with Los Angeles. I'm from Northern California, and as you know, Northern and Southern California, we're not supposed to get along. I've lived here now longer than anywhere else I've lived as an adult. And what I've discovered about Los Angeles is that there is so much history. You know, so many stories here, so many people who are native who have spent a long time, you know, not just the transient artistic community or dreamers who get sucked in to Los Angeles who come here. And I think with our theater company, we were founded in 2008 in the midst of a recession. We wanted to figure out, well, what does it mean to tell stories right now? What should we be focusing on? And we thought the best use of resources was to focus on people, focus on our LA community, focus on our LA artists, and focus on whenever we're developing new material to try to really think about what are the stories here in Los Angeles that are not well known.
Luis, your audio play follows this time traveler whom we heard of just a little while ago, and the tour guide, the kind of surly tour guide. Let's hear another piece of tape before we come to you.
Ooh! Is that an earthquake?
No, just life underneath. Chinese could not sell above, so they went below. Tunnels under Union Station. Lots of mazes and alleys underground with stalls, food, goods, everything. Black people first come to the area here, around Little Tokyo, and then they grow south, join the underground market.
There's a lot going on in this district.
There sure is.
No one talks about this enough.
Too painful. All the good stuff lead to change. And in this city, change is hard. Especially when you're at the edge of the ocean, the Pacific Rim. Nowhere to go but change.
Oh, you must be a poet.
No, just a tour guide.
She's just a tour guide. Luis, explain what's going on here and how you came up with this concept.
Well, you know, I grew up in downtown LA in an area called Pico Union.
Yeah.
So, you know, I grew up with, like, you know, I remember when we were kids, Betty Davis told us all to shut up because we used to go and disturb film shoots until they fed us. So that was our racket, right? And so I always, you know, people would come around on these tour buses, and I always thought it was like the most amazing thing to think, you know, I grew up in abject poverty and violence, basically. And I thought, you know, the bus coming around, I wonder what they're saying about us, right? And I remembered many years ago when I was in Chicago, I took a tour through what they call the Golden Mile, or what is it, the Miracle Mile?
The Miracle Mile, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, there was a tour guide, and he said, he didn't say much, and he said, you know, a plane comes out of the sky, and it falls into the river. The river's cold. Everybody dies. He goes, oh, that's Oprah's house. And I always remembered that the two things were, you know, water and Oprah's house. And so I thought, oh, how do I just sort of hit the highlights in 10 minutes? And try to give you a sense of LA, an LA that's always about shifting and changing, because for those of us who are natives here, we see the shifts and the change. You know, we see the strip malls, and we see the way a city can change and gentrify. And I'm one of those artists who have kind of made my way all over the city. I've lived like in, you know, Echo Park and Silver Lake and Pico Fairfax. And I just kind of follow the pre-gentrification waves of where to live, you know, basically.
There are people who actually chronicle their time in L.A. according to how many times the Beverly Center has changed the exterior. So
I so
when you
relate
say,
to that.
You know what I'm saying? So it's like when you think about watching that change, like witnessing it.
That's what's so exciting about writing this kind of a piece, is that L.A. is a character that speaks to you. L.A. is constantly in a kind of shift with itself. All of these communities and how they've been interwoven and shifted and migrated through just one sort of like section of land, right? And so really what I was trying to capture was the sound of progress, if that makes any sense. But when it modernizes, it also shifts in terms of who's doing the transportation, right? Who is engaging in the city in that way?
I mean, it's really exciting, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. I can't wait to hear more. Jennifer Chang, director of Chalk Lines, and Luis Alfaro, the playwright, with a piece in the show. I want to thank you both for coming on. Good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
By the way, Chalk Line launches Saturday and runs through the end of the year. You can listen for free at chalkrep.com, chalkrep.com. Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Summer, of course, is pretty much getting into full swing now. Boy, it sure feels like it. And maybe you want to find some refuge from all that heat by checking out new gallery exhibits. Catch up on the latest trends in the art world in an air-conditioned room. Wouldn't that be nice? Every summer, galleries all across Southern California exhibit group shows as a way to try out new artists. Maybe catch their breath before the big season, which comes in the fall. So there is a lot to see. And with so many group shows opening up, our art insider Lindsay Preston-Zappas is here to tell us the highlights. She's the editor-in-chief, of course, of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. Lindsay, welcome back.
Hey, Steve.
Why this format? I mean, why are group shows such a great avenue to try out new artists in the summer?
Right. So as you said, we see this every summer. It's like, oh, the summer group shows are up again, you know. So the art world in a way follows an academic calendar. There's these big fall shows that happen. And then in the summer, we kind of like take a little halftime and there's a lot of group shows that happen. And, you know, often group shows are organized under a cohesive theme, so it can be a way to kind of track a trend or kind of get a group of artists together that maybe share a specific lineage or style of art making. And, of course, it's a way for these galleries to try working with new, younger, emerging artists without fully having to commit to them. They're sometimes not represented by the gallery, so it's a way for these galleries to kind of try them out and do something that I think is important for the community. You know, it's a way to highlight young, emerging artists.
You're going to talk about several shows, three of them that you've seen. What's up first?
Right. So there's a really intriguing show that actually just opened yesterday at Shoshana Wayne. It's called Above and Below, and it's organized around the idea of craft and weaving. So it includes artists that the gallery has worked with, some of them for a long time, and others are a bit newer to the gallery. And again, artists they might be kind of trying out. But the organizing theme here is fiber processes, craft processes like weaving, needle felting, quilting, beading. And, you know, it's really interesting because craft has sort of been on the rise in recent years in the art world. It used to be a bit taboo to show even ceramics or weaving in a contemporary art space. But it's definitely changing. And craft is becoming something that's kind of openly welcomed into the contemporary art discourse. And the show was just such a joyful celebration of those mediums. And it's so great to just see a full-on gallery exhibition dedicated to that.
Let's talk about the next one. I guess you saw something over at Tyler Park Presents, another group show. Explain that
one. Yeah, so this one, again, they brought in an outside curator, actually two curators, and the show is called I Am Not This Body, and very kind of provocative title. And it was actually taken from a piece of writing by an artist, Barbara S., who was a photo faculty at Bard and actually recently passed away. And Evan Whale, who co-curated the show, along with Juliana Pacciulli, studied with Barbara S. So there's this kind of sentiment there. It felt really kind of heartfelt and sentimental, to a way to kind of honor her legacy. And the exhibition deals with the body and sort of its limitations. Evan and Juliana are both photographers, so there's a lot of work in the show that's photo-based and really involves depiction of the body in a state of being abstracted or kind of broken down in some way. And it's a really interesting group of artworks that kind of deals with that subject.
And finally, you're going to take us to Malibu, kinda, with what's called, quote, The Beatitudes of Malibu, but this has nothing to do with religion. This is the definition of beatitude, which is like bliss, right?
Right. Yes. And that is something that I think this show connects to nature and landscape. The exhibition is a really beautiful, kind of fun, multi-generational show that's all about landscape. And it includes realistic paintings, abstraction. There are historic artists from the early 1900s, like Millard Sheets, who's always fun to see. Some of these artists are approaching nature in a really pastoral, kind of traditional sense. But then you also have younger up-and-coming artists like Lauren Halsey, who I definitely wouldn't think of as a landscape artist. But, you know, she makes sculptures and installations using objects that represent South LA. So by including her, there's this really interesting sort of expansive view of what a landscape can be and what it looks like within the landscape of Los Angeles and this kind of mix of urban and nature. So the show is a full-on salon-style mishmash of all these different artists and kind of approaches to the subject. And the title actually comes from a poem. There's a small book of poems that was published alongside the exhibition. And so the title borrows its name from a poem by Rowan Ricardo Phillips, which sort of starts in Malibu on the PCH and then moves into downtown and back to the ocean in this really interesting circular way. So I think, again, the show really encapsulates the landscape of both natural and urban life, and even thinking about the human mind as its own landscape, which I think is a really interesting and expansive way to think about it.
All right, a lot of great group shows in the summer, getting ready, of course, for the big season of the fall in just a few months. Lindsay Preston-Zappas, Editor-in-Chief of Carla. Lindsay, thanks.
Thanks so much, Steve.
That's all the time we have for this evening. Tomorrow, it is Pride Month, and as LGBTQ plus communities celebrate, and other communities do as well, we converge on an identified safe space that one group found along the coast. We'll take you there. But you know what? There are still a lot of safe spaces missing for a lot of people. That's tomorrow. Join us online, by the way, anytime at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Tell us what you're thinking. Maybe you have a story idea. You can certainly subscribe to the podcast, kcrw.com/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Amy Ta, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, and Christian Bordal all had hands on this evening's show. Thank you for your ears and your time. Have a great night. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Take care.